And it's a real pleasure to welcome you to this book launch event to discuss the very timely new edited volume put together by my colleagues Kate Mistry and Hannah Gurman, entitled Whistleblowing Nation: The History of National Security Disclosures and the Cult of State Secrecy. I really, really enjoy doing these kinds of events, book launch events, because we're historians and the sort of gold standard of what we do is books, is history books. And in this terrible sort of age of the plague, we never actually get to see each other as we normally do. So it's a real treat to be able to do this. And although we have the disadvantage of not being able to actually physically be together, we have the advantage of being able, at really very little cost, to Zoom in people from different cities, different continents, across the oceans, which is fantastic. So to tell you, just by introduction, a little bit about this book, it's just come out from Columbia University Press, and it is an edited volume, so it's a collection of just wonderful scholars looking at the, I think it's really the first comprehensive history of whistleblowing in the United States, going all the way back to the First World War, but then reaching forward into our present day, including a lot of whistleblowers that you might be familiar with. I mean, people like Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, and others that you might not be so familiar with. But of course, you know, given the recent history with Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, this is an incredibly timely event and a reminder that history is relevant, and historians have something to say and something to offer on issues of tremendous contemporary relevance, which is the sort of obviously cause I care greatly about, and I know many of my colleagues care about. So let me just introduce briefly our speakers. We're going to hear first from the two editors of the volume, who are with us today. Kate Mistry is a historian of what we call the US and the world. He teaches at the University of East Anglia. His own work, his first book was entitled Waging Political Warfare, The United States, Italy, and the Origins of the Cold War, which came out in 2014. And he has an earlier edited volume entitled Reforms, Reflection, and Reappraisals, the CIA and US Foreign Policy since 1947. And he is leading this large AHRC-funded project with Hannah, one of the products of which is this fantastic collaborative volume. Hannah Gurman, who's joining us from New York, teaches US history and American studies at NYU's Gallatin School of Individualized Study. She is the author of The Dissent Papers, The Voices of Diplomats in the Cold War and Beyond, which came out in 2012. And she is also the editor of A People's History of Counterinsurgency, which came out in 2013. So we're very, very happy to have, and pleased to be able to have Hannah with us from across the Atlantic. And we're very, very lucky to have as our commentator today someone who's very familiar to most of us in this field, Andrew Preston, who is Professor of American History and Fellow of Clare College at Cambridge. He's also our current leader, the president of our humble society, the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations. So he's one of those people who actually, for reasons that mystify me, want to provide service to our community, which is a thankless task. So thank you, Andrew, and it's wonderful to have you with us. Andrew's own work is extensive. He's the author editor of 8 books, most recently American Foreign Relations, A Very Short Introduction, which came out in 2019, and Rethinking American Grand Strategy, a book that he co-edited with Elizabeth Bogwart and Christopher McKnight Nichols, which I think is coming out next year. So he's currently writing a book on the idea of national security in American history, as well as editing volume 3 of the Cambridge History of America and the World. So he's a very busy man, and we're very lucky to have him. So I'm going to hand over now to Caitlin and Hannah to take us through this fantastic volume, and then we'll turn to Andrew. Can I just ask everyone else, please, if you can, to just make sure you're muted, and I suggest you click on speaker view, which is probably the best way to follow the discussion. So over to you, Kate and Hannah.
Great. Thank you, Rome. Thanks to Grant and everyone at LSE for hosting this talk. It's great to see so many people, including some friends. We can see the names coming up. We live our lives online far too much, but this is one of the benefits of being able to come together despite being locked up in our homes. So thanks again for hosting. This is actually our very first book talk. The volume came out in, I think it was March, April, just as we were going into the first lockdown, or the first lockdown in the UK had started. So it's a circle of sorts to be able to launch it as we come out of the second UK lockdown. So as Ron said, this volume comes out of a project that we had been leading back, which started in 2017 on the history of national security whistleblowing. The origins of this stretched back a few years earlier. I'd been on a fellowship at NYU. I was doing some research on some whistleblowing cases, particularly during the 1970s, which is probably the most famous historical period for whistleblowing. You mentioned Ellsberg, for example. This is where Hannah and I first started speaking. And it was a period where the disclosures by people like Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden were starting to make headlines. So we were following the stories like everybody else, and as historians are asking, obviously, the historical question, curious as to the roots of this phenomenon of an insider from the national security state making revelations. So there was the obvious parallel with the 1970s, the other sort of big moment, if you will, for these sort of national security disclosures. But it also spoke to deeper issues around secrecy, questions of civil liberty, and accountability. And so we set out to sort of explore this history and examine it. And we were fortunate to get some support from the HRC, who funded the project and allowed us to assemble a really great collection of scholars from different backgrounds, different stripes. So as much as we'd like to think we were prescient, we didn't anticipate whistleblowing remaining so prominent or having such a prominent role in contemporary US politics. So we started this before the Trump era, but so many of the moments of the Trump era were marked by instances, examples of whistleblowing, all the way back in the 2016 election, the allegations of Russian election interference. That story was, of course, corroborated in many ways by Reality Winner, the revelations, her case of whistleblowing. Then, of course, you have the impeachment of Trump, all the way at the start of this year, which feels like an age ago, but the roots of that impeachment were, of course, whistleblowers on Trump's alleged dealings with or claims to sort of influence events in Ukraine. And even more recently, there was a whistleblower complaint against the Trump administration for ignoring warnings about COVID-19. This came from a public health official, an official by the name of Rick Bright, who is now on Joseph Biden's transition team. He's on the coronavirus task force for Biden. So again, as much as we'd like to think we were prescient, it speaks to a bigger issue of whistleblowing being part of US political and social landscape in many respects.
All right. Hi, everybody. So Caitlin and I are going to piggyback a little bit on our introduction of the book. Yes, just following up on what Caitlin was saying, I'm going to talk a little bit about the framing of the book. So this is really the first attempt at a comprehensive and interdisciplinary history of the phenomenon. And as Rohan was saying, we try to take that history back to the early 20th century. And we also try to take a holistic approach, which is to say that we're not just looking at whistleblowers in isolation, but we're interested in how the phenomenon of whistleblowing relates to issues of press freedom, the right to know, questions about accountability, dissent, and security. And we're also interested in the way that the phenomenon pervades popular consciousness and political culture, both inside and outside of the state. So we're looking not only at the political and legal history, but also at the cultural history and the social history of national security whistleblowing. And a few things to say about the framework, because that's really one of the greatest opportunities and challenges we encountered, is like, what do we mean by whistleblowing, and how is whistleblowing framed, and how are we framing whistleblowing? So suffice it to say, whistleblowing is a very contested concept from the start. And one of the things we ran into right away was a very limited framework for whistleblowing. So some things to say about those limitations. One is that almost inevitably, when a whistleblower is the subject of debate, we're stuck in either a hero or a traitor binary. Whistleblowers are either romanticized or vilified. And so that really creates a lot of limitations for how one can historicize the phenomenon. Along the same lines, we're falsely presented with the choice of either liberty or security. So these two extremes tend to limit the way we frame the debate and therefore what one can do to historicize the phenomenon. And similarly, you have a kind of claim that whistleblowers either are a salvation, kind of the panacea to all the ills of democracy on the one hand, or on the other hand, that they pose an existential threat. So again, these kind of polarizing divides. And then the tendency to see the phenomenon as a left-right issue and to try to map it on to a left-right politics, which, you know, for any historian of national security is a red flag, because the politics of national security don't map so neatly onto these partisan divides. The history shows that the politics of whistleblowing is really rather messy. So that's a kind of a framework that we really wanted to get beyond. And then there were also a lot of practical and conceptual challenges for framing whistleblowing. It's not like you can go to the archives and, you know, just type in, you know, whistleblowing and everything you need is going to come up. The term itself it doesn't map so neatly onto the phenomenon. In addition, the term whistleblowing doesn't really come into play until the 1970s. So we're looking at cases that precede the naming of the phenomenon in many instances. And it's not really widely discussed beyond the social science literature. You have a plethora of literature in the social sciences about whistleblowing, how to, what not to do. But for historians, it's really not so much on the radar. So there wasn't a lot of secondary literature we could really rely on. We were really creating some of the frameworks that we wished had been there for us. And then, last but not least, the term and the framing is so contested that how one names what is or isn't whistleblowing from the start becomes a big part of the challenge. So you mentioned Daniel Ellsberg, who would be widely recognized as one of, if not the most famous whistleblower. And yet, according to the government, he's not a whistleblower. What he did was an act of unauthorized disclosure. So those labeling, the contest over how one identifies a whistleblower, created a lot of challenges for us in trying to map out how to historicize the phenomenon.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about the characteristics, because as Hannah said, there's a great contest as to who is labeled a whistleblower. So the way we try to sort of get beyond some of those very black and white binaries and problems was to try to chart the characteristics of it. And as you look back, the characteristics remarkably are quite consistent. So we identified probably five stages, if you will, as to how a whistleblower can be characterized. The first one is obviously an insider who has some sort of privileged status, access to information, who takes that information and places it in the public realm. It's a public disclosure that's challenging the status quo of that organization. Secondly, the individual's identity authenticates that information that's being exposed. And this is where you can draw a line and perhaps differentiate it from leaking, for example. The third step is that the individual, the whistleblower, tends to be dubbed as either a hero or a villain, as Hannah said. A very limiting sort of framework, but there's a lot of obsession around personal motives of the whistleblower, perhaps over ideologies, and this is agonized over. The fourth step is that the state moves to persecute them, often through the law, but sometimes not necessarily through statute, but in some shape or form is an attempt to sort of clamp down on that. And then the final phase is one where questions about the character of the whistleblower really displaces the sort of substance of the disclosure. So if we look at Ellsberg, it's more about Ellsberg himself as a person, what he's like, his anti-war views, him as an individual, rather than the Pentagon Papers. And again, this pattern has repeated itself in virtually every example, if you go back over the past century. Again, it's across politics, it goes beyond left and right, and it's very much embedded in US political culture. And in this way, there's something distinctly American about the national security element of whistleblowing and what makes it different from other countries like the UK, where the phenomenon is quite different. So the roots of this contest about the label of whistleblowing, I think, comes down to two very different visions of what whistleblowing is. So on the one hand, you've got the organizational defender. This is someone who, if they have misgivings, will go through internal channels. They'll make a disclosure to correct a wrong or to improve an organization in some way or form. This is recognized by the state because it keeps the disclosure in-house. So while it can be less influential in terms of historical significance, it's one that generally aids that organization. The second type of whistleblower, and this is probably the more famous one, is the public defender. They tend to go through outside channels, normally the press, and this is a disclosure in the public interest. While you can have an emphasis or a desire for reform, the responsibility is much more towards society rather than the leaders of the organization. The key thing is that this is not recognized by the organization or the state in this instance. And most of the most famous and influential cases historically have been this kind of public defender, right? Remains in the public conscience. It's the Ellsbergs, it's your Snowdens, it's these sort of cases now. So a lot of the problem also comes around to this idea of public interest, which of course is subjective and contested, but that still shouldn't detract, I think, from the fundamental difference between whistleblowing within the national security state and whistleblowing outside of it with the aim of informing the public.
Right. And added to that is the question, the million-dollar question of national security. Because there is whistleblowing in many sectors, but we were specifically interested in national security whistleblowing. Whistleblowing as a general term is popularized in the 1970s by Ralph Nader. It's defined as someone who is driven by a public interest over organizational interest, and who blows the whistle on wrongdoing or illegality. But the problem there is that in Nader's concept, it was applied mainly to the corporate sector. or in some cases the public sector, not to national security. And so the state developed some protection, setting up whistleblowing channels for federal whistleblowers. But from the beginning, national security is carved out as an exception. So for example, the first statute to protect federal whistleblowers, the Whistleblowing Protection Act of 1989, decidedly does not protect national security whistleblowers. It's placed in a different category, national security, of course, because it's dealing with state secrets. And people will say things like classified information, but it's actually both classified as well as unclassified information that becomes subject to this big exception to whistleblowing in the realm of national security. And that's why, instead of having protections, historically, national security whistleblowers will face retaliation. And the main form of retaliation, of course, has been the Espionage Act of 1917, which gets invoked time and again, periodically, to retaliate against whistleblowers. Other forms of retaliation also came into play later on, things like censorship, pre-publication review, to try to keep this phenomenon from being part of the whistleblowing realm and to see it in the form of unauthorized disclosure, state secrets, and there you enter the realm of black and white, national security, espionage, and loyalty, really taking it out of the realm of whistleblowing. So more recently, particularly under the Obama administration, you did have the introduction of some internal mechanisms that were supposedly protecting national security whistleblowers. But it's very important to acknowledge the limitations of those mechanisms. They're, for one, internal reporting channels. So there really is no public interest disclosure in the realm of national security possible. They're not rooted in statute, and they're very limited. They're really designed to protect things such as waste, abuse, and fraud, not questions of dissent from policy, for example. And they're very subject to internal meddling because the internal reporting, as we saw in the Trump administration, goes through the Inspector General. So very much inside of the national security executive establishment, not an independent kind of process. And this hasn't done much to stop retaliation. Many of the figures who have used internal channels have been retaliated against. And not only the whistleblowers, but also those associated with them, their lawyers, journalists, increasingly, and the NGOs that work with whistleblowers. So that's one of the other things we wanted to stress, is that when you're studying whistleblowing and the history of whistleblowing, you're not just looking at the whistleblowers, but you're looking at the degrees of separation from them and how you have a kind of circle of involvement that expands beyond the whistleblower themselves.
So we'll wrap up with a couple of sort of points before handing over to Andrew. We have seen a remarkable sort of explosion of cases in the 21st century, just in terms of sheer scale. But despite the volume, the characteristics, again, of these cases are consistent with that longer historical trend. The Trump administration and Trump himself accelerated in that unique way of his, brought into sharp focus some of these longer standing issues around whistleblowing, like really get to the heart of some of the tensions between secrecy and democracy. And Trump, if when he does leave, will not sort of see the end of whistleblowing and some of these tensions, because they very much will remain under Biden when he takes over in January.
And to the question that historians, I think, are particularly interested in is, what does a history of this phenomenon do? And I think one of the things that it shows is the structures and the frameworks that are so limiting that we come up against, they are, of course, historically created. They're not eternal. And by studying the history, often improvisational, You could see different paths that might have been taken and different paths that could be taken. And it kind of breaks down the sense that this is inevitable or sacred, that these frameworks are always meant to be and ought to be. So that is a kind of cause for hope, I suppose, the usefulness of the history. And also to kind of get us beyond some of the tired frameworks, one of the things that we concluded is that, yes, of course, whistleblowing is not a panacea to society's ills, and nor is it an existential threat to democracy. But in important ways, both direct and indirect, the fates of democracy and whistleblowing are linked. So if you care about one, you ought to care about the other to see the ways that they are deeply entangled and that this history really illuminates. So I think we'll leave it there. There's obviously a lot more we want to say, but it will be more interesting bring in questions from Andrew and then eventually to hear from everybody else.
Thank you so much, Hannah. And thank you, Caitlin. That's fantastic. I'm very impressed, by the way, by your seamless tag team. I've never seen that done so well. So now I'm going to invite Andrew to share with us his thoughts on the volume and maybe pose a few questions to the editors. And we can have a little a small discussion amongst the three of you before opening it up to discussions from everyone else. So over to you, Andrew.
Great. Thanks, Rome. And thanks to Caitlin and to Hannah for editing this book and for inviting me to LSE to talk about it. It's a fantastic book. It raised a lot of questions. I'm going to pose four of them, but I can't stress enough, and I'm going to return to this at the very end, just how much I got out of reading this book and how much I enjoyed reading this book. And it really is a book to be read, unlike a lot of edited volumes where you can dip in here or there. You can still do that with this book, but it really does reward a reading of the book as a book. Because it's so original, because there's nothing else like it, as both Caitlin and Hannah just said. And it's full of revelations. And I'm going to touch on some of those as I go along. But I wanted to start, if everyone will let me, with a personal story. I met Dan Ellsberg, who, as Caitlin and Hannah said, is probably the most famous whistleblower in American history, at least. And I met him at Schaefer in 2002. And implausibly enough, he was the commentator on a Schaefer panel that I was on. It's a long story as to how he became the commentator on this panel, but the short story is he had a personal connection to somebody else who was giving a paper on the panel. And we had a chair, we had, you know, three presenters, and then a commentator. So it was a very traditional Schaefer panel, but with the comment being given by Dan Ellsberg. So this is in 2002, and I was, I had just come out of my PhD. I was presenting a chapter from my PhD. The other panelists were also, they were a little more senior than me, but they were early career people. And initially the program committee had assigned us into a normal sized room. So the conference was at the University of Georgia. We were in a classroom. I think we were in a classroom for 20 or 25 or 30 people. And then word started getting around that Ellsberg was the commentator. And so we ended up being moved into, because people were expressing interest in this one panel, we were moved into a room that must have seated well over 100 people, because it looked like there were well over 100 people for this pretty ordinary non-plenary Schaefer panel. And Ellsberg was a rock star. I mean, people were mobbing him. They were asking him for autographs, even his fellow panelists were not above asking for an autograph, as I myself did. I don't know if you can see this through the glare, but it's the cover of Time magazine that is actually referenced in the chapter in the book that's on Ellsberg, and he signed it to Andrew for Peace and Truth, Dan Ellsberg. So, and he was mobbed by the people at Schaefer. He didn't actually, I don't think he read the papers, because in his comments, which went on for a good 40 minutes, he talked about Iraq. Because this is in the summer of 2002, so it's in the run-up to the Iraq War. He didn't refer to any of the papers. He referred to Vietnam only in the context of the build-up to war in Iraq. But it didn't matter. We didn't mind. We loved it. Felt like we were a part of history. But he was a celebrity, and he was respected. He was really respected, even by Schaefer members who had an issue, a moral issue, which you could tell from the Q&A, which of course wasn't about Vietnam at all. It was all about Ellsberg. And some people had an issue with his leaking of the Pentagon Papers. So that was really interesting. By a strange coincidence, a month earlier, so in May of 2002, I also met Robert McNamara, Ellsberg's bete noir, at a conference in Cambridge, where I did my PhD and where I now teach. And it was a conference, it was a much smaller conference, and people were giving papers, mostly early career scholars were giving papers on aspects of McNamara's career. So people were talking about Vietnam, obviously, which I was, the World Bank, Ford Motor Company, liberalism, all sorts of things, mid-century liberalism, all sorts of things. And what struck me when I met Ellsberg a month later was the contrast between these two men. Whereas Ellsberg was a rock star and reveled in being a rock star and was good at it, really good at it. He just oozed charisma in this kind of public intellectual rock star type of way. McNamara was, in his temperament, in his personality, in every other way, he was completely different. He was a broken man and he was trying to put himself back together. And in retrospect, that began with In Retrospect in 1995, by the time he came to Cambridge. He also, by the way, gave did one of these small conferences at LSE on that same tour where he spoke at Cambridge in May of 2002. And he commented on the papers that people gave, including my paper. So it was a real, it was really daunting to have McNamara comment on a paper on McNamara. But what struck me was the difference in these two figures. And of course, McNamara had conceived of and orchestrated and oversaw the Pentagon Papers that would later make Ellsberg famous. And at this conference, McNamara was tearful. He would tear up frequently. He was obviously wrestling with his conscience. And as I said, the contrast between these two individuals could not be more stark. They had both been made by the Vietnam War, but in totally different ways. Ellsberg as this rock star and McNamara as a broken man trying to rebuild himself. And there's this personal story kept coming back to me when I was reading Caton and Hannah's book, because it struck me that there was something deeply counterintuitive in my memory, which is not a unique memory, of Ellsberg and McNamara. That Ellsberg, the whistleblowing subversive who was harassed by the police and tried in courts and his psychiatrist's office was broken into, Ellsberg, the subversive, was made by Vietnam in the best possible way. It made him, as I said, it made him a rock star, it made him a celebrity, but it also gave him this kind of intellectual esteem and made him famous, and it legitimated him, and it also legitimated his ideas. Whereas the man in the gray flannel suit, and McNamara, if nothing else, was the ultimate man in the gray flannel suit, the man who wielded state power, the ultimate establishment man in Robert McNamara, was ruined by Vietnam, and he was especially ruined by the release, by Ellsberg's release of the Pentagon Papers. And a year after Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers, a young anti-war protester tried to throw McNamara over the side of a ship on the Martha's Vineyard ferry as it was going from Woods Hole to Vineyard Haven. And McNamara fought him off. But the Pentagon Papers was very much a part of that anger that people had for Robert McNamara. There's also a hidden irony, I think, in this story, in this Pentagon Papers story. And that is that McNamara himself was a kind of whistleblower. In conceiving of and orchestrating the project in the first place. McNamara conceived of the Pentagon Papers as a way to hold policymakers to account, but privately, to hold them to account to themselves, to figure out how on earth did we get in this mess? How did we make so many mistakes? And that's not the kind of whistleblowing that Caton and Hannah are talking about, but it strikes me as a kind of whistleblowing, not the public kind, but then it took Ellsberg to make it that public kind. And I find it hard to believe that McNamara didn't anticipate that someone somewhere would leak the Pentagon Papers study. I don't think he envisioned that it would be Ellsberg going in late at night and Xeroxing the thing and then sneaking out and giving it to reporters. I think he probably thought it would eventually be done by his friends in the Kennedy School, by political scientists, other social scientists, maybe historians, and it would be done in a kind of gradual rollout. So he didn't anticipate how it would be done, but I find it hard to believe that McNamara didn't anticipate that it would be leaked. So it is a kind of whistleblowing, as it were. And one of the things that I absolutely love about this book, this utterly absorbing book, this hugely interesting book, is that it revels in these kind of paradoxes and ironies. As both of them said, as both Caitlin and Hannah said, they promise us a nuanced approach to whistleblowing, and they very much deliver in this book. It's a really interesting investigation of a tightly tangled issue in two polyvocal dimensions. So the first dimension is this binary between liberty and security, which I think Hannah was the one who spoke about. And then the second dimension has kind of three overlapping levels between the legal, the political, and the ethical. And at times reading the book in an entertaining way, not in a confused way, I felt like I was watching Inception, the movie Inception, that has dreams within dreams within dreams, and you keep going through different layers and you're trying to make sense of it. And one of the things I loved about the book was that the book does make sense of these multiple layers, even when I didn't agree with what the individual contributors were saying necessarily in their chapter. The book's nuance, its avoidance of a heroes and villains approach, is very welcome, and it succeeds entirely. It's an incredibly difficult thing to pull off with something so sensitive, so the editors are to be applauded in striking that balance. Though I think, and I'd like to push them a little bit here, they definitely, both Caitlin and Hannah, in editing this book, definitely avoid the heroes and villains approach, but it's put pretty clear where their sympathies lie when it comes to the state as an actor. So the portrayals of whistleblowers and of whistleblower motives, especially someone like Ellsberg, is indeed very nuanced. But when it comes to the state is kind of this, it comes across in the book as a kind of monolith. And the state is always repressive. And the state always tries to hold on to secrets it shouldn't necessarily hold on to. And the state reacts in a wanton, I think the most commonly used adjectives that are in the book in referring to the government's response are things like indiscriminate and disproportionate, and you know, things like that. That it's just this kind of monolithic thing that is reacting against whistleblowers, and it's coming down hard on them. And so, for the whistleblowers themselves, the book definitely strikes a balance that doesn't. It's not hagiography, in other words, of somebody like Ellsberg or Snowden, which would be so easy to do in a book like this. But when it comes to that dichotomy between private individuals or individuals and citizens, and the state. It's clear where the editor's sympathies lie. Okay, I don't want to take up any much more time. I've already taken up too much time. So I just wanted to flag up four big questions that this book prompted in me as I was reading it. One is the comparative dimension. Caitlin and Hannah write that, quote, whistleblowing is, of course, not unique to the United States, but the scale and frequency with which it occurs is. And so this isn't a kind of qualitative exceptionalism, as in the U.S. is this great country with a special destiny, but it is a kind of exceptionalism setting out that America is different. At least that's what I took from reading the introduction. And I would like to know why. I'd like to know why the U.S. is different. This might be an unfair question because this book is about the United States, but the editors themselves have raised it in saying that whistleblowing is not unique to the United States, but the scale and frequency with which it occurs is. And I'd like to know why. Is this simply because the U.S., the scale of American national security, of the national security state, is larger than other democracies? Or is there something distinctive in American political culture that makes whistleblowing so prevalent? And there are hints here and there to classical liberalism and maybe some other explanations, but I'd like maybe to hear more about that from Caitlin and Hannah. The second issue is periodization. So the book quite rightly details a long history of secrecy and of attempts to unveil that secrecy or to break through that secrecy through things that would later come to be called whistleblowing. So it takes whistleblowing and it puts it in a long durée, but it quite rightly, I was completely convinced by the argument that they make that the 1970s or what we might call the long 1960s is a key turning point. And this is really where whistleblowing emerges as a thing, not just national security whistleblowing, but also in the corporate sector. In fact, initially in the corporate sector, as the book makes clear. And yet, as the book does make clear, political secrets, skullduggery, war crimes have been happening for a long time before. And in fact, if you're to find a war where there were, you know, per capita or on a, you know, adjusted for the timescale of the war, the war that might have the most war crimes that could have been revealed would have been the Korean War and not necessarily Vietnam. And so I'd like to push them a little bit more on why the 1970s. Okay, so you have Ralph Nader paving the way and talking about whistleblowing and holding auto companies to account and that kind of thing. But that begs the question, a similar type of question, why is Nader finding success, finding a voice in the 60s and 70s? I mean, corporate wrongdoing, corporate malfeasance and greed and corruption is also not new. And the progressives held it to account in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And Caton and Hannah are very good at sort of drawing the links to the progressive era. But there's a big gap between those two eras. So I'd like to know more about why the long 1960s or why the 1970s, as they call it. There is a kind of crisis of legitimacy going on. What had been common practice in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, early 1960s that is still going on is no longer acceptable. What had been acceptable is no longer acceptable. And I'd like to know why. And there's a quote that they, a line that they have that I'm going to use in my own, I'm going to cite it in my own work. As Rowan mentioned, I'm writing a book on national security. And they write on page 34, national security whistleblowing is a modern phenomenon, which I think is absolutely right, but I've written in the margins of my copy, but that isn't that because national security itself as an ideology is something so capacious? Isn't it because national security itself is a modern phenomenon? At least that's what I'm going to be arguing in my book, and I'm going to cite this book as evidence and support, and I'd like to know if the editors agree. Okay, third, I'll try and be a little more, move a little more quickly through these. The third theme I wanted, of my four themes or questions that I wanted to draw and ask the editors more about, is the insider-outsider distinction, or what we might call the public-private, or what I'm going to call the public-private distinction, so insider and outsider. And so Caton and Hannah identify whistleblowing as something committed by, quote, a state insider. And one of them in the introductory comments referred to insiders. And I don't necessarily want to disagree with that, but I would like to sort of muddy the waters a little bit, because as I was thinking of the two most famous, at least to me, the two most famous whistleblowers, and I think probably to the audience as well, of Dan Ellsberg and Edward Snowden. But you could also put Reality Winner in this category as well, I think, although correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know much about Reality Winner. But they could be classified better as insider-outsiders, because by the time they're whistleblowers, they are either in the private sector, like Ellsberg, working for RAND, although RAND isn't exactly a purely private sector institution, or they're working for private companies and subcontracted to the US government. So Snowden, I believe I'm correct in saying this, that he was paid by Booz Allen, right? And then and he was contracted out to the federal government. And so I don't really think of Ellsberg, and Reality Winner was also working for a consulting firm by the time that she became a whistleblower, and I forget exactly which firm she was working for. But they're kind of private actors. They're not necessarily state insiders. And I want to know if that matters. If my sort of wondering about where they were in the dichotomy between public and private or insider outsider, does it matter that they were kind of in this interstitial space between public and private, and working for a private corporation that was then contracted out to the US government? And the institutions that those whistleblowers reveal their secrets to are not government officials. They're not fellow state insiders, even though they tried to. And I found this so fascinating about the Ellsberg case, that he goes to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee first. He goes to Fulbright first and wants to reveal his secrets. And the US government doesn't want to have anything to do with it. And so Ellsberg then turns to the media, which is, again, in this kind of interstitial space between public and private. They're private corporations, the New York Times, Washington Post, but they serve very much a public duty, and they have very much a public interest that's recognized in the Bill of Rights. So do these distinctions matter? Do they enlighten? Or is it a bit messier than that between the insider-outsider dichotomy? And the fourth and final one is another dichotomy, and this is between secrecy and privacy. And it's not something that the editors dwell on much in the book, and I'd just like to know how they feel about these questions, or if that was an intentional strategic decision. But thinking about the differences between secrecy and privacy, and whether they matter, and whether they matter to a study on whistleblowers. So secrecy and privacy, my sense of those two terms, both in political culture, public discourse, but also in political thought, is that the former is bad and the latter is good. That's a gross oversimplification, of course, but just in the interest of time. So between secrecy and privacy, secrecy is bad, privacy is good. Secrecy is usually claimed by the state or maybe by big corporations. They're secrets, they're trying to hide them. Ellsberg calls his memoir Secrets for a reason. And individuals have privacy, right? Privacy is a human right. Nobody says secrecy is a human right, but people talk about privacy as a human right or as a constitutional right, as the Supreme Court said in 1965. and then in 1973 and onwards. So I'm wondering if that matters. And the reason I raise this is because it's really interesting how citizens themselves act on this dichotomy between secrecy and privacy. And it's incredible how people are willing to allow the state to have its secrets. So if we think back to the initial reception that Snowden got in 2013, he was a hero to some, but a majority of polls showed Americans to be more critical of him than more supportive of him. Not by a lot, but if it came down to a zero-sum game, winner take all, he would be put in the villain category according to the American people. And also, as we see from, there's no way if citizens weren't willing to give up their privacy in exchange for something, it could be security or it could be free services. If they weren't willing to do that, then Google would not be worth so much money. All of those social media companies would not be worth so much money. So this good, bad distinction that the editors, I want to be clear to the audience, the editors don't make that simplistic distinction. I'm sort of reading into it. And it gets me back to the comment I made about how Caitlin and Hannah, how I read their view of the state, where they see state secrecy as kind of a bad thing, even if the individual personal whistleblowers are themselves complicated, nuanced figures. I want to know more about how that actually plays out, not in the ethical realm, not in the legal realm, but in the political realm, where people are willing to give so much broad leeway to the government in exchange for, or to private corporations in exchange for X, Y, or Z. And I just want to finish that last point just with a quote that they have by Obama at the top of page 2. They quote Obama in the wake of the Snowden revelations. Obama says, "Our nation's defense depends in part on the fidelity of those entrusted with our nation's secrets." And I think that would be a majority view if you put it to the public. And I want to know how that complicates the story of whistleblowers. These people, as the chapter on Ellsberg makes clear, these people who kind of have this messianic, for good reason, but have this kind of messianic mission, self-appointed mission to reveal the truth in a way that may not be supported by the public in whose name that whistleblower is acting. So that's my fourth sort of big issue that I wanted to raise. I'm sorry to have droned on a bit, but it just, I think, reveals just how stimulated I was by this book. It's a fantastic book and I recommend it to all, and I've been using it for my own research and I'll be using it for teaching as well. So congrats to Caitlin and Hannah, and I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you so much, Andrew. That is fantastic. I mean, so much food for thought there. Caitlin and Hannah, why don't I give you a chance to maybe comment on those four questions that Andrew raised and anything else you want to raise before we open it up to Q&A from all of our participants, who I'm sure are eagerly waiting to pose their questions to you as well.
Great.
Wow. Great, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. Caitlin, how do you want to divvy this up?
I'm happy to sort of take a stab at a couple of them and then...
Okay, and I'll piggyback from there.
Okay. So thanks to Andrew for that very generous and probing critique of the book. I'm really glad that he sort of found the book readable and that it was something that you recommend reading as a book, because although it is an edited volume, our hope was very much that it would be seen as much as a co-authored book with all of the contributors, as opposed to your standard sort of standalone collection where people chip in their pieces and sometimes there aren't as many links between them. I was struck by that Ellsberg story about how he's this rock star, at least for historians, at least for the Schaefer crowd. But it did get me thinking. I mean, the fact that he was considered a celebrity, he had all this esteem, was rooted obviously in his act, but the fact that he was free to be out and he was able to attend conferences, that he was able to speak. It wasn't particularly clear whether Ellsberg would be sent to jail or not. We are approaching the 50th anniversary next year of the release of the Pentagon Papers. There were, of course, two cases of the Pentagon Papers. One involved the press's right to publish that story, the New York Times, which goes to the Supreme Court, And there was a second case which involved Ellsberg and whether he had violated the Espionage Act. That case was famously thrown out because of Nixon's plumbers, right, who broke into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office and Watergate, et cetera, et cetera. But Ellsberg could quite easily have gone to jail, and he wouldn't have been able to go around to academic conferences and feel like a rock star. So it's kind of interesting how this persona of Ellsberg, it could have been very, very different. And it was the circumstances of the time that really meant that his trial didn't go ahead. It was because of, obviously, Nixon's shenanigans. But if it went to trial, the odds are that he would have been prosecuted, he would have gone to jail. So that was kind of interesting. Andrew's story was, as he was telling his story. In terms of the points, I'll have a go at the first one. I'll tackle that on the comparative dimension. Whistleblowing itself is, of course, not unique to the United States, but sort of the way that we've traced it, there are some aspects of it which make it unique to modern America. And a lot of that is related, I think, to questions of the First Amendment and freedom of speech. So why is it that there are so many cases, and why is it that there are so many individuals who are prosecuted having made disclosures? And a lot of that comes down to this sort of contest between civil liberty, the state's right to have secret, the press's rights to publish them. You compare that with the UK. The UK has an Official Secrets Act. A lot of other countries have Official Secrets Acts. The United States doesn't. And the reason is because of the Constitution and the First Amendment, which means that the state cannot keep secrets according to the Constitution. Right. One of the, we talked to Hannah mentioned that many of the frameworks that we operate in with today, we sort of take it for granted that they've been around forever. And secrecy would be a classic one. It's created, right? It's a modern phenomenon, and I absolutely agree with Andrew's point about national security being a modern phenomenon. The classification regime in the United States emerged in the early 1950s. It's created by executive order, right? It's what a president decides. Doesn't go through Congress, it's not in statute. Each presidency will tinker with it, but it's essentially an executive project, right? The classification system. We can go into the details of how people get prosecuted for it under the Espionage Act, but it really is a hodgepodge. And we've got a great contribution in the book by Sam Lebovic, who writes about the espionage, and he sort of teases that out. But it's very much an ad hoc, improvised piece of legislation, and gets to very much the heart of why the US context is different from other places. The fact that so many people can go to jail and yet their revelations are global, which says something also about US power in the 20th century and the 21st. One other thing on insider outsider, I think absolutely right in terms of where these individuals like your Snowdens or your Ellsberg, they're not technically in the state, but I think they epitomized the military industrial complex, if we borrow from Eisenhower. There the line, I think, the more interesting way or more appropriate way to think about where the line is around the classification of information. So yeah, Snowden will be technically hired by Booz Allen, that's where he'll get his paycheck from. But he's sitting in the same sort of office as a government employee, as other contractors. Their badge will be slightly different, but the work that they're doing is essentially the same. They have the same access to the same information and whatnot. And he even talks about this, I think, in his biography or in various talks he's given, that he himself changed companies. He was working for other, he was a subcontractor for another firm, and all that changed was, again, his badge or whoever paid his paycheck at the end of the month. But the work he was doing was essentially the same. Now, there is a difference in terms of sort of whistleblower insider channels for those who work for the state and those who work for private companies, but the line between inside and outside is not so much if you work for the US government or whether you work for Booz Allen, it's whether you have access to classified information or not.
Okay, so I'll piggyback from there. First, thank you so much, Andrew. That's really so rich, so many questions to address. I'll see if I can try to fill in some of what Caitlin hasn't yet addressed. But also going back to the wonderful contrast that you painted between Ellsberg and McNamara, I found that fascinating, and it reminded me of the first book that I wrote, which was about dissenters. And always that question of, you know, what counts as dissent. And, you know, we are focusing on whistleblowing now, but there is more, I think it's more accurate to speak of a continuum. And that this question of whether to go public faces many, particularly high-level internet dissenters historically, and then maybe in the digital age, you see the middling figures that become more prominent. That's somewhat of a different way to periodize the phenomenon. Probably the McNamara as whistleblower speaks again to the 1970s, which is the periodization question, right? When does this question of the ethics of going public become more pressing upon somebody who's working within the national security state? And I think that, first of all, I would point people to Jeremy Verone's chapter in the book, which does a nice job of trying to situate the figure of the whistleblower, so to speak, within the culture of protest. And it becomes somewhat of a question of, you know, chicken and egg, right? There's, as you said, there's a crisis of legitimacy that's happening more broadly, a culture of protest that is percolating. At the same time, there's something distinctive about whistleblowing in the national security state that deserves more attention, in part because what you have, and Jeremy does a really good job of describing this, is a transformation, right? If you want to think of, there's like a narrative that kind of encapsulates what happens to a whistleblower. It's very important that this person be a kind of loyalist to the national security state at one point, and then go through a conversion process of sorts to become, to see almost himself as a whistleblower. And that is a profoundly cultural act. I think it couldn't exist without a larger culture of protest, and also without a sense of the national security state to begin with, and who occupies it, and the culture of secrecy that had so effectively kind of contained or prevented such acts up until the 1970s, which isn't to say, I mean, as we say, there were others who disclosed secrets, but in part, it wasn't recognized as a phenomenon because it didn't have a cultural name or a cultural recognition attached to it. So that's a kind of long-winded way of saying that it's part of a larger culture of protest, and I think changing culture within the national security establishment, at least for some, though not for most. And I agree with Caitlin that the insider-outsider tells you much more about the vast national security apparatus and how it really does kind of extend its tentacles into other areas, so that even when you are considered an outsider, you're in many ways still an insider. I mean, the cases, Caitlin's chapter on the 1970s shows you how people like Frank Snepp, who wrote books about their experiences based on unclassified information, faced, you know, censorship well after the fact that they leave. So there is a sense in which once you're inside the national security state in many different levels and have access to information there, even unclassified information, you become part of this vast apparatus. And I guess that's another way of saying, yes, we definitely, I think you make a good point when the state is monolithic. And I guess we err on that side to point out the overreach. As you say, that word we use over and over, I think, because it is accurate. The amount of information that became subject to these kinds of sanctions just vastly extended its relevance. And so to encapsulate the inequity and the imbalance of power when a whistleblower goes up against the state, that isn't to say that the state always wins. So if you want to be more subtle, there are losses. Ellsberg is, you know, the prime example, the mistrial. That isn't to say that there isn't some disagreement, decisions not to prosecute. More whistleblowers are not prosecuted than prosecuted. We don't find out about those. But it is to say that that structurally the cards are stacked against them. And I don't think there's really any other way to see it but that. And that is also a cultural, it's both structural and cultural, because I would also agree with the statement that the majority of Americans support state secrets. We also support in principle that a state has a right to keep secrets. But I guess, you know, if you see us tilting in one direction, it's to point out that historically that sphere is just so extensive that it can capture almost, you know, things that don't belong there. And then lastly, I mean, I'm very intrigued. I don't think I have very much productive to say about the secrecy privacy paradox that you point out. I think it also does point to, you know, some gaps in the book, that we don't address the role of corporations and the way that, you know, you mentioned Google. We don't have a chapter in which we, you know, devote to these questions about privacy in the corporate sector, and questions about individuals' willingness to give up their information. So I think I'd be really interested to hear what other people have to say about that, because I really don't have, you know, much to offer, actually.
Okay, thank you so much, Hannah. So I'm going to invite the participants to pose questions through the chat function. So if you'd like to write your questions into the chat, and then I'll pose them to our panel. While people think of their questions and write them up, I will take advantage of my position and maybe just kick off our discussion, building on the really very interesting points that Andrew posed. So I guess I have one where I'd like to sort of begin is the question of politics. So the way that you talk about whistleblowing is it seems to me rather devoid of politics. It's the long durée of history, and there's the archetype of the whistleblower and the state and the individual. But we don't really hear much about Democrats and Republicans and the political context. So I'm wondering how much does politics matter? How much does it matter whether a Democratic administration is in government or a Republican one? Does the politics of the whistleblower herself or himself matter? And to what extent, you know, does the kind of shifts in American politics influence the way in which the public then either embraces or rejects that whistleblower? I mean, as I was listening to you, I was thinking of Colonel Vindman, the NSC whistleblower who, thanks to whom, you know, the whole impeachment process against President Trump really, really began. And the way, you know, at the end of the day, the consequence for him was really losing his position at NSC and then being reassigned and then eventually having to leave government service altogether. But as far as I know, he hasn't been prosecuted, which I found surprising. So I'm just wondering what you make of the politics of that, and how does that compare to the past? I noticed that Caton's chapter in the volume deals with the 1970s, and Hannah, your volume, I think, deals with Iran-Contra and the sort of 1980s moment. And Iran-Contra is a subject close to my heart, but I've also worked on the 70s. And one of the things that strikes me talking to people who do research on Iran-Contra is that, you know, nothing really of consequence happens, you know, as a result of this. If you compare the public outrage of the 1970s to, you know, Watergate, the Church Committee, the Pike, all the revelations that came out of government wrongdoing, you compare that to the relative sort of non-event in terms of public outrage at what was happening, at what the Reagan administration was doing. I mean, does that tell us anything about the politics of whistleblowing and how that politics has shifted? And that's before even the age of, you know, counterterrorism post 9/11 world. So I just want to start there with this question of politics, and does politics matter, and how does it matter for understanding whistleblowing?
Yeah, thanks, Ron. The politics question is a really tricky one, because when we look at particularly the 70s, even the present day, your natural inclination is to think that these are episodes rooted in sort of an aversion to state secrecy, pro-peace, pro-civil liberties, and it's quite simple to map that on to the broader political divisions around, say, something like Vietnam or the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What makes it difficult is that you've got multiple layers of politics. You've got the politics of the individual, of the whistleblower, and that is very difficult to sort of get beneath the surface of, or to move beyond the celebrity, as sort of Andrew was talking about as well. Very few whistleblowers leave papers, will have a diary, will have all those classic sort of resources that a historian will go to. There are sort of two essentially whistleblower personal records of whistleblowers. One, which is at NYU, the Philip Agee papers, and the other are Ellsberg papers, which will be released next year. They're being categorized right now. They'll be at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, which will be a great collection and really fascinating. But in terms of the sort of broader political question, one of the most striking things was that the consistency across sort of administrations, from your Nixon to Carter to an extent, certainly Ford, you really see it with Reagan continuing through the 90s. And the classic example would be George W. Bush and Obama. They, if anything, Obama accelerated the sort of prosecution tools, the targeting of whistleblowers. If we think about politics, I mean, George W. Bush, Obama, even Trump, there would be very few issues on which they would coalesce. Whistleblowing and the approach to sort of unauthorized disclosures, as to classify it, would be the key consistency there. Or if we take somebody like Charles Grassley, right? He's a senator, quite prominent senator, who one of the most outspoken defenders of US whistleblowers in terms of your sort of classic insider figures who will be calling out fraud, waste, abuse. Grassley was a key driver behind the Whistleblower Protection Act being enacted in 1989. But Grassley is also one of the most vehement opponents of a Snowden, and he would have been an opponent of Ellsberg as well at the time. So when we talk about the state, and I think Andrew has a fair point with regards to our perhaps characterization of the state as monolithic. But when you drill down, you see a lot of consistency between sort of the three branches, the executive, the congressional, and the courts. They are very much on the same side, and it's around that unifying concept of national security, which, ask any historian, they'll talk about the classic bipartisan consensus, and particularly so during the Cold War. Even at this moment of great stress in the 70s, the state comes out of that with secrecy intact, if anything, stronger than ever.
Mm. Yeah, and I would just add that, you know,
sort of period of consultation.
You do see periodically the bipartisan consensus breaks down around moments that are particularly polarizing at a partisan level. So the moment that we're living through now is one in which the Democrats were supporting whistleblowers like Vindman. But it's also important to note that Vindman was not, at least in our framework, a public interest whistleblower. He's somebody who reported to an inspector general. And so it's a difference, you know, it does give itself an air of legitimacy. And the Democrats really doubled down on that in their kind of support of the witnesses against Trump, making sure that they had used internal channels. But also, since you mentioned, you know, the Reagan era and the Iran-Contra affair, I think, you know, it's fair to say that Reagan very successfully maintained that bipartisan consensus. In addition, I mean, in my chapter, I focus on failed whistleblowers, people who did kind of disclose information about the Contras in particular. And partisan politics did play a role in their lack of credibility. In that case, it was because they were, like, you know, seen as right-wing nut jobs. They happened to be, you know, in the Reagan camp. And so in an interesting way, the liberal establishment press was less interested in hearing from them. They didn't really have credibility. And so there is a kind of credibility politics that plays into these questions about which whistleblowers get believed. It doesn't always map so neatly onto partisan politics. We have, you know, there are examples in the book where, you know, gender, is it, you know, is there a reason why, I mean, more whistleblowers that we know of are men, but also a kind of politics of masculinity and the different forms of masculinity that enable some whistleblowers to be recognized as legitimate and others less so. So we think that politics plays into it, but partisan politics surprisingly less so than maybe other forms of politics. And then you come back to questions about, you know, the politics of national security overriding, as Caitlin was saying, some of these partisan dimensions.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, well, I have many more things to ask, but I'm going to hold fire because I want to give other people a chance to pose their questions. So we have a question from Grant Golub, who's one of our PhD students in the International History Department. Grant asks, have you found that politicians who have supported whistleblowers in their careers and then later became president have shifted their views on whistleblowing? I'm thinking of someone like Barack Obama, whose administration strongly pursued journalists who published whistleblowing materials and whistleblowers themselves. Does entering the presidency change your view once you have access to the most sensitive material in the government? Or are there other factors at play that make American presidents different, make American presidents from different political parties react similarly to leaking and whistleblowing?
Okay, so I can sort of take a stab at that one. The Obama, I may be mistaken, but I don't recall him expressing particularly strong views on, or at least support for, whistleblowers before he came into office. But the more interesting, I think, historical case of a president or somebody running for office would be Jimmy Carter, I think back in the 1970s. Carter ran on a platform, or one of the aspects of his bid was restoring decency, honesty, after the Nixon era. And he championed himself, or he claimed he was a champion for whistleblowers, for people within the government who notice abuse, fraud, these illegality, to be able to speak up. Now, his model whistleblower wasn't a Daniel Ellsberg, it was an Ernest Fitzgerald, who, going back to a point that I made in my opening remarks, is very much the state's ideal whistleblower. Ernest Fitzgerald spoke about cost overruns on military procurement, basically overspending by the Defense Department, who were being scammed, according to Fitzgerald, by private companies. That was the kind of whistleblowing they had in mind. So Jimmy Carter comes in as a champion of whistleblowers and soon runs into this dynamic, which I guess Obama has also experienced, that once you're in the position of authority and you're dealing with this information, it's not just about the rights and wrongs of whistleblowers. It's you're responsible for the entire national security state. And there are so many other pressing issues, right? And this is inevitably one of those questions, one of those issues that falls down on the list of priorities. Ronald Reagan also ran as a champion of whistleblowers, funnily enough. And Reagan did as much as anybody to sort of fortify the modern national security state, at least as we understand it today. But the point about Obama's focus on journalism and journalists is really important, I think. And that will be one of the more damaging legacies, I think, of the Obama administration, that opening the door to not just prosecuting state employees or the state private, if we think about contractors, but to go after journalists, and not just your Julian Assanges, but people who work at mainstream newspapers as well.
Great. Thank you, Hannah. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that question.
No, we can take another question.
Sure. Our next one is from Tom Ellis, who is an LSE fellow in the International History Department at LSE. Tom asks, I was wondering if you could comment on disinformation and ersatz whistleblowers. What do the popularity of conspiracy theories like QAnon, which revolves around a supposed high-level whistleblower, tell us about the place of whistleblowers in contemporary American culture? Are there any historical precedents for this?
That's a good, really good question. And I think to begin with, it does kind of drive home the point that the whistleblower is in the eyes of the beholder, right? The question of, you know, QAnon, well, QAnon, first of all, is anonymous. So that is one issue that we briefly address in the volume, that whistleblowing, for the most part, is identifiable, right? So historically, the person who is the whistleblower is known, whereas in the case of QAnon, we don't know who it is. But I think the question does raise a larger and more interesting point that, like, speaks again to this notion of what is in the American political tradition that might give rise to or make fertile ground for whistleblowing. And I think there you're going back to the classic questions about the role of paranoia in American political culture, and to some extent in the narrative of whistleblowing. So I think we have the historical phenomenon of whistleblowing, but as a couple of the chapters in our book point out, you have to have a narrative around it. In order for us to talk about whistleblowing, it has to be narrativized, you know, by historians, but also in popular culture and political culture more broadly. And I think that whistleblowing is, you know, not to necessarily condemn it, but it belongs to a larger tradition of distrust. Now, that can work, you know, extreme right, extreme left, center, but, you know, distrust against the kind of what information is kept by the powers that be, and the idea that you need someone to reveal them in order, you know, to bring truth to the people. So on the one, we're kind of stuck as historians. On the one hand, you know, there is a sense in which we are trying to hold the state accountable, but we're also analyzing a phenomenon that has the potential to be dangerous. And so I think one has to acknowledge that there are people out there who call themselves whistleblowers, who operate within this tradition, and do pose genuine dangers, and that it is, I think, on a continuum. It is part of American political culture.
I should just say, because Hannah's too modest to mention, but she's written a great op-ed in the Washington Post about QAnon, so you can check out that for more. Which got me thinking also, the Washington Post, their sort of tagline now is democracy dies in the dark, right? And it still, it comes back to that question of, you know, secrecy. When Andrew mentioned that it's a sense that the state has secrets and it's and that's bad. It's that dark sphere, and we're also always looking for some sort of revelation or light. And that feeds into the popular idea of what a whistleblower does. But very rarely does light lead to much change, which I think, Rohan, you mentioned as well. And so what happens? And you can say that with Ellsberg as well, right? His case, his whistleblowing doesn't change the war. The war goes on, gets worse. Snowden hasn't ended surveillance as well. So there is often this false sense that whistleblowing is going to be revelatory and that it's going to lead to meaningful change. But that's not how the history has sort of panned out.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I don't see any more questions in the chat. So I just maybe want to give each of you, Andrew, Hannah, Caitlin, an opportunity to raise anything that you think we haven't covered or that's important to take away from the book, maybe before we move to conclude.
I actually don't have anything else. I left it all in the field for the comments. But I just want to, and I do want to give Caitlin and Hannah the last word of the panel, but this has just been a fantastic discussion. And I just want to recommend the book to anyone who's, because it touches so many fields. So to those of you who are studying, I mean, various aspects of American foreign relations or American political developments or lots of other topics, I really, really highly recommend this book.
Absolutely. Hannah, Caitlin, anything else you would like to add before we conclude?
I mean, there's so many other aspects of the book, I guess, that we could go on about, but we'll save the audience. We spend too much time online, and we're really appreciative of people coming voluntarily sitting on a Zoom call that's not related to meetings or teaching or whatnot. But I mean, I would sort of round off by saying is, well, firstly, to thank everybody for attending and thank you all for sort of putting this together. I think the whistleblowing phenomenon, as we've said, is not going away. If anything, there will be more cycles. My sense is there'll be the continuation of peaks and troughs. The 70s were a key period. The early part of the 21st century was a key period. I suspect it could be another 30, 40 decades before we see another one. And the conditions of those two sort of high peak periods of whistleblowing are kind of interesting. Unpopular wars or long-running wars that became very unpopular in the United States, this fragmentation of society within the United States, but also internationally, these were unique conditions that sort of created this sort of groundswell of opposition, but also within the national security state. We often think of the state as faceless, right? But there are individuals within them that are populated by it. And it's growing, it's larger than ever. And these people, the vast majority won't say anything, but all it takes is one person to speak out to make headlines. The phenomenon won't go away. It may not be in the in the headlines for a while, but the phenomenon of whistleblowing and these questions around secrecy and democracy, I think, will remain.
Yeah, I want to thank everybody as well, and I don't want to take any more time, knowing how much time we spend on screens. I guess I would just say, you know, one thing that the book touches on, but doesn't go into a lot of depth, that I like to talk about with people when I get a chance, is the kind of digital question. How is whistleblowing changed in the digital age, and how does that affect what is insider, what is outsider? I mean, Caitlin notes in his chapter, you know, whistleblowers used to write books. Now they release data. So, you know, is that change significant enough? You know, what does that mean for the phenomenon? Who gets to be a whistleblower and who doesn't in the digital age? How is whistleblowing received in the digital age? So those are all questions. I mean, we are historians. We're probably not, and neither of us are really experts in that area. There is one chapter by Matthew Jones that tries to deal with this question of uncertainty in the digital age that I think is worth taking a look at if you're interested in those questions. Anonymous and people who go into the deep state, take deep dives into the deep state. The future histories are going to have to deal with those questions. And so that's just not something we're able to get around to, but I think it's really important to address.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree.
Rowan, just to add on,
please.
a small point there before people at LSE start freaking out and about Matthew Jones. That's a different Matthew Jones from the Matthew Jones.
Yes.
Because I was confused by that when I read the book too at first.
This is not Columbia huge, Matthew Jones.
Right. Yeah. Columbia,
yeah. That's a cool name, right? I mean, what are the odds that two academics could be called Matthew Jones? But anyway, it's a different Matthew Jones.
Yes.
Absolutely. So I've posted in the chat the link to the Columbia University Press website, and Kate and I have kindly provided us a discount code. If you want to order the book, you can get a 30% discount with that code there, CUP30. So I encourage you to check this book out. I've been looking at it the past few days and just going through the table of contents, and it is very difficult to put, those of us who have put together edited volumes know this, it is very difficult to put together a volume that is actually quite coherent as this, and that, you know, has so many strong chapters in it. And that's really, that is a very hard work for editors. So I really, all that remains to say, for me to say really, is congratulations on a fantastic book. And I'm sure it's going to really shape the historiography on this subject as the first comprehensive history of whistleblowing. Thank you very much to everyone for joining us. Well done. 1.5 hours on Zoom is not easy. But it's a little easier when you have such an interesting topic to talk about. Please do come back and join us again for our events at the Ideas Cold War Studies Project. And just thank you again to Kate and Hannah and Andrew for taking the time to join us today. It's just really lovely to see you from the prison that is our homes these days.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.